to another episode of UBC Arts on Air, a lively program profiling UBC faculty and students from the Faculty of Arts. And I'm your host, Ira Nadell. Today, political scientist Max Cameron, much in demand this week as an analyst of the recent federal election and a specialist in democratic institutions. Max, welcome.
Thank you, Ira.
Have you had a chance to catch your breath since Monday's events and consider the consequences of this outcome and the event?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, this has really been one of the longest and most grueling election campaigns that I've certainly ever covered, and it's been interesting. I think it was a really important election. I think Canadians understood that the level of turnout reflects an interest in the election. I think that's a very good story. And I think on balance, my main interest is how does this affect our country's democracy? And I think it's a good result.
Now, can we take that a step further? You say, how does it affect the country's democracy? How does it affect the democracy? Other than people on Tuesday say, okay, this is a terrific outcome. I think it's terrific.
Yeah.
Or I don't think it's terrific. Then what? So how does democracy respond to these changes?
Well, you know, I think that what we've had over the last, decade has been, and even before that, there's been over time, I think, a real erosion in the functioning of our democratic institutions. We've seen really since the 1960s a growing concentration of power in the hands of the Prime Minister's office, extraordinary level of party discipline. Very few free votes in the House of Commons, a real kind of hollowing out of our Parliament, where increasingly ordinary members of Parliament have less and less say in initiative, more and more is done in the Prime Minister's office. And I think that in particular, Stephen Harper, as Prime Minister, did a lot of things that went against our country's sort of conventions and customary practices. So, for example, the use of omnibus bills, which included very complicated and sometimes quite draconian changes to our regulatory framework, to our laws, were put through Parliament without much debate. Committees stopped working effectively as spaces for cross-partisan dialogue. We saw the question period becoming more and more of a kind of pantomime of deliberation. So the fact that we have a new government, which I think to his credit, Justin Trudeau, more than any of the other leaders, with the possible exception of Elizabeth May, really kind of took on the criticisms of the functioning of Canadian democracy, and he has committed himself to no omnibus laws, no prorogation of Parliament, making committees, choosing committee chairs by secret ballot, more free votes for independent members of Parliament, looking at the Fair Elections Act and changing the elements of it that make it harder for people to vote, and putting parliamentarians in positions of oversight of our intelligence agency, and last but not least, some kind of electoral reform. So I think that there's a possibility with this next Parliament that we begin to reverse this gradual erosion of the way in which our democracy has been functioning and put us back on a track to rebuilding and strengthening the functioning of democracy.
So it sounds as though there's a decentralization perhaps forthcoming.
Yeah.
You've suggested that the PMO's office was the principal source of many of these decisions and certainly these actions.
Right.
But can a political party actually not reverse if change the direction of these institutions?
Yeah, it's interesting. Justin Trudeau actually said at one point during the campaign that he acknowledged that the concentration of power in the hands of the Prime Minister's office had really begun under his father's administrations. And he liked the symmetry of that being altered by his own prime ministership. And so, I think that there is some kind of commitment there. But by the same token, I think we also have to recognize, and I think this is probably for me the biggest surprise of the election, is that we have a majority government. It's not a minority, which many people, including myself, had anticipated. And so that, I think, has important implications for, on the one hand, I think it actually gives the government the capacity to do things, but may actually diminish its motivation. So we'll have to watch closely and see how much of the promises are delivered on, because there is a tradition in Canada of opposition parties promising a lot of change, and then when they get in power, not delivering that much.
Yes, not delivering. That anticipates, actually, what I wanted to ask you next. What are the disadvantages of a majority government?
Well, I think what our current first-past-the-post electoral system tends to produce is what my colleague at the University of Toronto, Peter Russell, refers to as false majority governments, right? Governments that have roughly 39-40% of the popular vote, but a majority of seats. That was the case with Mr. Harper, and it is exactly the case with Justin Trudeau as well. He has about 54% of the seats, but he only has 39.5, roughly, percent of the popular vote. These are false majority governments. In the case of Mr. Harper, I think it was particularly problematic because he governed so consistently on behalf of his own base and really was not particularly concerned to try to build broader coalitions or reach out to the opposition or be more inclusive in his style of governance. He pursued a strategy that Tom Flanagan calls sort of minimum winning coalition strategy, right? You get the minimum votes you need to have power, and then you focus the benefits on your own constituency, make sure that they're happy. And we saw the result of that in the election. You know, there's a third of the electorate that was pretty solidly behind Mr. Harper, even though they didn't particularly like his leadership style. I think with Mr. Trudeau, he represents the second choice of many. In fact, the reason he's prime minister is not because there were necessarily 40% of the electorate who wanted him as their first choice. There were an awful lot of people who, in fact, I think at the outset of the campaign, clearly intended to vote for the NDP. And that percentage shrank over the course of the campaign, particularly in Quebec. So we now have a prime minister who also has a false majority government, but on the other hand is, I think, has a greater disposition to govern on behalf of a wider understanding of the kind of Canada that he represents, but also, I think, in fact, represents, has a bit more goodwill on the part of a broader swath of the electorate.
So the day after he won, as I'm sure you know, the first thing he did is he went to a subway station in Montreal.
That's right.
Is that authentic, or is it just good photo ops?
Well, you know, I think it's photo ops. I think it's there's a kind of a, you know, he is a likable person. He connects with people. I don't think he's charismatic in the way in which his father was. I don't think this is Trudeau-mania, but I think there's a genuine, there's something genuine and authentic about him, and I think people saw that and they liked it, and I think he deserves a lot of credit for an incredible campaign, an almost flawless campaign. The concerns about him being, you know, just not ready, really at the end of 78 days after you'd seen him time and again in these various debates and on the campaign hustings and dealing with issues, it was pretty clear that this is someone who deserves a certain respect. He's a really impressive politician.
Well, I mean, he used that one word, ready, at the end
yep.
of the campaign on those TV ads,
yes.
which I saw. I thought that was extremely effective.
A lot of good political jiu-jitsu. I mean, the ad about the hair was another example of that. And also, I think, in a way, the campaign started out being about the economy. That was what the Conservatives felt was their strong suit. They represented responsible management, proven leadership, et cetera, et cetera. People looked at the economy and said, well, it's actually not doing that well. And so the conversation began to go into the territory of barbaric practices, snitch lines and niqabs, and is Mr. Trudeau going to mean that there is going to be, you know, your kids are going to have access to marijuana at the corner store and brothels and safe injection sites in your alleys and so forth. And all of that kind of stuff, I think, tended to shift the conversation away from what's best for me and my family and voting one's pocketbook to what kind of country do we want to live in? I mean, what kind of place is this? Are we a place that's narrow and mean and angry? Or are we a country that's hopeful and strong and upbeat? And when the conversation became about fear versus hope, it started to look like Mr. Trudeau was the natural winner of that debate.
Hope prevails.
Yeah.
So I want to shift ground a little bit. Tell me about your interest, your personal interest in political science. How did this all develop? Were you a budding high school politician and decided to carry it forward, or did you kind of fall into it after you dropped out of chemistry?
Well, that's very funny, because as a matter of fact, I was the prime minister of the model parliament in the Fredericton High School back in 1979, and I created a party that was called the Average Man Party. And our slogan was Volt Amp, and you know, it was a pretty I love it. Pretty sexist title, Average Man Party. You never get away with that nowadays. It shows how times have changed. But it was a lot of fun, and it gave me a real taste for parliamentary politics. I'm fascinated by how parliamentary institutions work. Most of my work has actually not been on Canada. I've worked more on Latin America and other parts of the world, and focused on issues of democratization, and only gotten back into Canadian politics as a consequence of my role as the director of the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions. And one of the things that we're doing there is creating institutes for preparing people for politics, a summer institute for future legislators. And we're delighted that that program is up and running. It's now we've had 3 years in which we've run this program, and we've just received very excited to receive word from the Vancouver Foundation that we have funding for the next 3 years. And what that's all about is training people to go into politics better prepared, to understand the kind of skill and knowledge that's necessary to be an effective legislator, and giving them, through mentoring with skilled practitioners and simulations and model parliament exercises, so back to being in model parliaments, a chance to learn about our institutions so that we avoid the kind of gradual process that we've been seeing in the country, in which parliamentarians have become less and less important in reality.
So is this program open to anyone who thinks at some point in the future they may want to go into politics, or do I have to have won an election?
No, it's actually, we prefer people who have not won, who have not actually entered yet. It's for preparing people who, before they go into politics, and their reasoning for that is, and it's not campaign training, so we're not training people about how to get elected, but we're saying if you want to go into politics, but you don't think you necessarily have the skill or knowledge to be effective, come and try out our program, and maybe you'll get a sense that this is the right thing for you, or maybe it's not the right thing for you, but you'll learn a lot about how parliamentary institutions work and what it's like to be a practitioner of the art of legislation. And the only requirements are you have to say to us that you at some point would like to run for office. You don't, that's not a firm thing. I mean, there are people who might, for example, see themselves as civil servants working with parliamentarians, and to do that well, they might want to be able to be to put the other hat on and get a sense of what it's like to be on the other side of that relationship. But for the most part, we want people who say, yes, I would like to run for office, and the other criteria is to pay the modest fee, and you're in. And we've actually had one person, Heather Sweet, elected in the Alberta legislature in the last provincial election in Alberta, and a number of candidates have run in this election. Unfortunately, none of them were elected, but they ran on Green ticket, Conservative ticket, and many of our people certainly deeply involved in many of the campaigns, including some of the successful ones.
Are there similar institutes around the world, anywhere
nothing,
in the world?
Nothing like it
this
exists
anywhere. This is unique.
Yeah, it's absolutely unique, which is incredible. I mean, I think it's really quite astonishing, because if you think about it, if you want to be a doctor, a lawyer, a teacher, a firefighter, an entrepreneur, a nurse, you know, there are schools for all of those things. These are professions that we take seriously because you don't want somebody going into an operating room not knowing what they're doing. You don't want a firefighter who doesn't understand fire, you know. What about politics, right? These are the biggest, most complex enterprises in our society, right? To become a federal legislator or provincial legislator means to be making decisions around budgets that are in you know, tens or hundreds of billions of dollars, and they're making decisions around legislation that affect our lives down to the most minute aspects. And yet we have no place for people to get training to do that, except on the job. And that is, of course, it is the kind of thing that you learn through practice. But we believe that you can pick up some of those skills, particularly in an environment in which you can make mistakes and learn from them. And it's not too costly. Because, I mean, look at the number of candidates who flamed out. There was the guy who peed in the cup. There was the woman who made the off-color joke about Auschwitz and didn't know what Auschwitz was. I mean, there's all sorts of people who go into politics evidently unprepared. And we hope that people who are serious about being a legislative playing a legislative role might come to our program and have an opportunity to get a sense of what that actually looks like before they go into politics so that they are better prepared when they do.
Who teaches in this program?
Well, we include a lot of practitioners. So there's both an academic and a practical component to it. We've got my colleague Jerry Beyer is one of the lead academics, and we've got a number of other people who do some teaching with him, an army of graduate students who are facilitators of conversations and resource people. And we rotate through practitioners from across the political spectrum. So one of our biggest volunteers has been Preston Manning. He's an incredible, inspiring, true sort of small-D Democrat. He talks to us about issues like representation and constituency service and how to make laws or unmake laws. And then we bring in Anne McClellan has been, again, a stalwart part of the program. She was a former deputy prime minister under two prime ministers, and she's talked with us about a wide range of issues in the life and politics. Mike Harcourt and Joy McPhail talk about work-life balance and relationships and politics. And we every year we draw on George Abbott. We draw on many people, and we rotate it, so each year is different. But the real value for many of our participants is that opportunity to rub shoulders with practitioners and get a sense of, you know, what makes them tick and how they think, and impart some of the wisdom that they've accumulated through their experience.
And presumably people from across the country can participate in this?
It's open to anyone, and as a matter of fact, not only across the country, but we're hoping to turn this into a kind of a program that we can franchise around the world. So we will probably be doing something in Alberta next year. There's a very keen interest. We've had a cohort of participants 2 years in a row who've come through the Alberta Union of Public Employees, and Heather Sweet was one of those people. So they like this program a lot, and they would like us to take it on the road to Edmonton. I have also been speaking with people in Peru. The Catholic University of Peru is very keen on partnering with us to do something like this for Latin American legislators. So we're optimistic that we're going to be able to create a version of this now reconfigured for a presidential rather than parliamentary system sometime next year.
Sounds remarkable. So that leads me to, fortunately, I guess our last question because of time, but when are you running for office?
Yeah, no, no.
You have early experience, you told me.
Yeah, no. I mean, at an earlier time in my life, I thought that would have been a lot of fun, but I don't think you know, when you make the decision to be an academic, I think it makes a lot of sense to have a, you know, I've made a contribution, but it's not the full contribution I want to make. And so the idea of sort of abandoning an academic career halfway in order to go into a political career late in life and probably not get very far doesn't make any sense to me. I would encourage people to think about going into politics. You know, a lot of people go in either quite early. So students, if you're a student, that's a good time. A lot of people, some people go in mid-career, kind of mid-40s, around the time that Justin Trudeau did. I think his timing there was really, really quite good. And he's got a lot of years still ahead of him to do stuff.
But you're suggesting somebody in their 60s,
you could.
Could,
I mean,
be too late.
Yeah, a lot of people do that. I mean, but that would mean not a life in politics. That would mean I've done something else. I've had a contribution that I'm content with, which is not my case in terms of my academic career. And then, you know, maybe serve for a term or two, which means that you would be in all likelihood, you know, you could be a star candidate brought in to play a cabinet position. Probably at most, and that would be a great accomplishment. So you know, I'm not saying people shouldn't consider entering politics at any time in their life, but it has to be right for them. They have to have their family secure. They have to be sure that that's rock solid. They've got to be sure that they're ready to do this, whether they win or not, or whether they are in government or opposition. So there are a lot of things to think about.
Is there a questionnaire I could answer to determine whether I'm suitable or not? Have you ever thought of
something? That's actually a brilliant idea. Why don't we do that? I think we should have something like that. And it could be like these things that we do, where a vote compass to figure out for whom you support. Should you run for office? And a set of classifications or questions and criteria.
Well, yes, and that would be useful to see the beginning and the end, so to speak, you know, what you think when you perhaps originally, you know, participate in the parliamentary institute, and then how you feel at the end, and then you track this, you follow it up 6 months or a year later, what did that person do, and how have their ideas changed? I mean, it could be really interesting.
Well, what I loved about one of our participants who has, in fact, run for office and nearly got elected at the municipal municipal level here in Vancouver, was that, you know, she went through the program. She said, you know, I had no idea how hard it is, but it makes me want to do it even more. Now that I have a sense of the scope of the challenge, I think I can do this. And I found my tribe. I mean, if I've been with people who are political like I am, and she just got, it was a real thrill for her, and it made her decide to take the leap. And I'm confident that we'll see her sooner or later in an elected office.
Well, I think that's very, very inspiring, and I want to thank you for joining us tonight. Our guest, Professor Max Cameron from the Department of Political Science. It's really been a pleasure, and stay tuned for future broadcasts with the intriguing figures that make up UBC's Faculty of Arts. Thanks again, Max.
Thank you, Ira.